So today the topic of my talk is microscopic quantum optics. I think the only connection to strong gravity is that the motivation for me to do research in this direction is initially, at least, to study gravitational waves. So this is a very familiar topic for people here. You know, we need devices that can detect gravitational waves. For example, from in this figure is shown like two black holes going around each other. So you have accelerating matter, and then this causes oscillation in the space-time curvature, and this propagates to the Earth. But they really are very, very tiny effects. So in order to measure these strong gravity effects on the Earth with a meaningful sensitivity, you need to monitor test masses with very, very good sensitivity. So the illustration here basically shows that if you have two objects separated by a distance of L, which is less than the wavelength of the gravitational waves, then the motion, so these free test masses will be separated by, will be, have some additional displacement, relative displacement proportional to the amplitude of the gravitational wave and the initial distance they are separated. So, and to detect these waves, one important approach is to use laser interferometers. For example, here the illustration comes from the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. So you have a Michelson interferometer, so you have four test masses, which are suspended as pendulums. And these separation of 4 kilometers is just to mean to amplify the effect of the wave. So having an incoming gravitational wave, if it comes from top and if it has the right polarization, the wave will move this mirror and this mirror away. One of them will be away, the other will get closer, and vice versa. So you get a differential change in the arm length of this interferometer. So then if you shine some light, I guess this is better. If you shine light from this side, the interferometry basically, you know, the path length of these two arms changing would actually create a signal from here. And from this, you can try to measure the arm length difference. And having these two more mirrors here basically amplifies the amount of light in these cavities. And it also makes the interferometry more sensitive. So, and to have an idea of how sensitive these devices are, you basically make an order for magnitude estimate. For example, in 2007, when the first generation of the LIGO detectors went full sensitivity, the H, which is the gravitational wave amplitude it measures, is measured at 10 to the minus 21 with sensitivity that small. So you can translate that into a displacement of 10 to the minus 18 meters, and this is measured at around 100 hertz frequency. And the entire range is from 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz. So if you think about how would you achieve a displacement sensitivity within 0.01 second, you think about it in the following way. Basically, with an optical cavity, each photon can resolve a length, which is the wavelength of light, divided by the finesse of the cavity, which is, on average, how many times the light bounces in the cavity. So that could be 10 to the minus 8 meters for each photon. And then if you just if you inject 10 to the 20 photons within 0.01 second with this laser, so you can work out the power of the laser seem to be 100 watt here, I think, if you input it here at the beam splitter, then you can achieve that sensitivity. So in reality, the 100 watt at the beam splitter is achieved with another mirror here, which has some additional resonance.
This is just the root n.
Yes, this is just the square root of n. So, and then from this very, very simple estimate, you find out that you can estimate delta x from this argument, 10 to the minus 18 meters. And you can say that, OK, since I'm measuring at a certain frequency scale, I can estimate the delta p of my measurement as m times omega times delta x, roughly. Then you can see that, OK, this device has a sensitivity. If I multiply the error in delta x and delta p, it's 100 times h bar. So this is not very far from uncertainty, Heisenberg uncertainty. So in the second generation detectors, roughly this year, so next year, it's going to come online next year, hopefully. It has an aim of achieving 10 times better sensitivity in the displacement, and therefore it'll get close to the regime where, naively speaking, your uncertainty product will be close to h bar. So it means that the macroscopic object that we have will be close to the regime of quantum mechanics. And this really sets the stage for the discussions I'm going to have today. And then in the third generation, we will have a sensitivity that is even further. You know, at least we plan to have a sensitivity that's better. So if you just generate the delta x delta p product from this naive way, you find out that, oh, the sensitivity could look better than h bar. Of course, you don't violate the Heisenberg uncertainty. But what I'm going to show you is that there are techniques that will achieve a sensitivity in displacement that is very good. So the nominal product here could be less. But you do it in a way that you don't really violate the uncertainty principle. And then I'm going to show with this kind of sensitivity what you can do in terms of understanding quantum mechanics when macroscopic objects are involved. Because these mirrors are really very, very heavy. You know, in the first generation LIGO, this mass is 11 kilograms. In advanced LIGO, these masses will be 40 kilograms. So these are, yes.
So when you say second generation, is that an advanced LIGO?
Yeah, it is.
And when roughly is third generation?
Third generation is not a well-defined idea.
Just future.
But I think the plan is after advanced LIGO makes a detection, and then we operate for a few years, we will try to upgrade the detector. And then in Europe, there's the so-called Einstein telescope project, and people really try to redesign a new facility with much better sensitivity. So these things are, you know, they're not like fast, but there's plans for doing this.
So then is it fair to say that the objective with respect to this stuff for advanced LIGO is basically just to get the Heisenberg limit?
For me, for this talk.
Right.
For the most people, it's for detecting gravitational waves.
No,
right.
With respect to this,
yes.
They're not going to try to go past the Heisenberg limit with advanced LIGO.
Right. Yeah. So I will mention a little more. Yeah. So the LIGO project in the US there are these two sites, and they're separated by 3,000 kilometers. And then these are 4-kilometer devices, so they look really quite large in the usual scale. In the world, there's a global network of these detectors. In Europe, there's the Virgo detector and the GEO 600 detector. And in Japan, there's the 300 meter small interferometer, and they're building one, the Kagura detector, which is going to be 3 kilometers arm length, and they will really have a comparable sensitivity to advanced LIGO. And also being planned is a detector in India, which will have a comparable sensitivity to LIGO. So let me mention in more details, what is the mechanism for reaching this Heisenberg kind of product? So the very, very idealized sensitivity for measuring strain in a gravitational wave detector, you can ideally think about two types of noises. One type is so-called shot noise, which comes from the fact that you don't have enough photons. Well, the photons are discrete. And the more photons you have, the square root of n enhancement of sensitivity. So the shot noise comes from that mechanism. And this noise scales like 1/1 the optical power you have. And in the frequency spectrum, the shot noise is, if you have an interferometer with no cavities, then it's a white noise due to the Poissonian arrival time of these Poissonian arrival of photons. But then there's another type of noise, which is called the radiation pressure noise, which actually scales the other way with the number of photons. So the shot noise decreases when you have more and more and more photons. But when you have more and more and more photons, these photons, they kick on the mirror and they produce a random force. And this random force causes a noise. And that is why the radiation pressure noise scales like the square root of power and this 1/1 m omega squared, which is the Newtonian response of a free mass. We consider these the free mass because the pendulums have very low frequencies. So these are really just idealized units, just to illustrate this fact that you have two types of noise. So when you consider these two types of noise, as I said, if you increase the power, you decrease the shot noise, but you increase the radiation pressure. And also, if you do the other way, if you decrease power, you get more shot noise, more shot noise, but less radiation pressure. So in this way, you have a trade-off, and this actually gives you a so-called standard quantum limit, if you consider these two types of noise in this very idealized, naive estimate. And the calculation shows that if you calculate this envelope that is below all these curves, The envelope depends not on the details of the optical system, but only on fundamental constant, the mass of the mirrors, and the length of your cavity or your arm, because here I'm having a noise referred to the strain that you measure. In displacement, you simply eliminate that. So this limit is based very much on the property of the test mass, not on the specific way you measure these test mass. So, and then it looks like if you think about this following way, you can say that, okay, I have a spectrum. How do I convert a spectrum into an RMS error? Well, the conversion is, you know, you do the frequency band, you do so this hand waving kind of argument. You multiply frequency with the spectrum, you take the square root. That gives you the rough amount of error you have measuring this quantity. And if you do that, you find out that delta x delta p is sort of equal to h bar when you're at this limit, sensitivity limit. So basically what we're saying is that, okay, the sensitivity limit for measuring gravitational waves, having a standard quantum limit, having this trade-off between these two types of noise, actually corresponds to your test mass being at a quantum state where the uncertainty is near the Heisenberg uncertainty. Okay, so here is an indication of this. So, and now it's actually interesting. So this is just abstract discussion. It turns out to be interesting for advanced LIGO, right? So, you know, for the community of gravitational wave research, the reason for doing an upgrade of advanced LIGO, the reason for considering the quantum noise is because there's an actual need for improving sensitivity. You know, this from this curve, this is the advanced LIGO design sensitivity, which, you know, we even when we run this next year, we're gonna take a science run next year, but it's probably at a worse sensitivity. But eventually the device is predicted to be sort of capable of reaching this dashed curve. It's called the design sensitivity. And then if you compare the standard quantum limit for inserting the mass of these mirrors, you find out that there's not a big difference. So you're sort of at the regime where the uncertainty products, it's close to the Heisenberg. And then you can, if we also add another plot here, which is the design curve that we have for the LIGO 3, which is, you know, an upgrade that we think could happen after detection has been made and some observations have been done. If you compare this curve and compare the standard quantum limit for the masses we're planning, you can see that this noise really gets below the standard quantum limit. Not by a huge factor here in this plot, but it does show that the quantum, so this purple curve shows the quantum noise due to the shot noise and radiation pressure, and the black curve is the total noise. So you do see that the quantum noise does go below this standard quantum limit in the noticeable frequency band. So basically the major mission for detecting gravitational waves sort of also allows us to provide a regime where we can have such a quantum regime for the mirrors. Question, yeah?
Is it fair to say that the center mass mode of your test mass really is being cooled down to essentially zero temperature,
That could be a way to think about it. I think the more rigorous way to think about it is to say that if the noise goes below this curve, then you could design a scheme where you measure the outgoing light either through feedback or through considering the conditional quantum state of the test mass, then the conditional quantum state of the test masses after reducing the quantum state of the outgoing light should be in a state where the uncertainty is nearly Heisenberg uncertainty. So unless you do this processing, you will not have a state which is pure because the noise ultimately grows up. So the actual state of the mirror, the RMS motion of X and P in the actual device is actually pretty large. But you could control it in a way where it becomes less. So you could prepare the quantum state into a pure state. So that is the rigorous statement. But roughly speaking, that's the idea. You will have a regime where the quantum mechanics of the mirror will be really important.
So let me try just one more time. I'm sorry at this point, but is it then that the state of the test mass is not actually in the ground state? Mm-hmm. But if I look at the entangled state of the light and the test mass, are the kind of the Schmidt decompositions kind of the pairs are mm-hmm. those then the test mass will be in?
I think that is true. So those will be randomly walking around in the phase space. But if you remove the center, the mean value of x and mean value of p, the remaining uncertainty of x and p will be nearly ground state. Or not nearly, but a little bit close to the ground state.
Yeah.
So, and then we can try to analyze this in a little more formal manner, just to inject some equations, because this is a theoretical physics institute, I guess. So we can write down some coupling Hamiltonian between the mirror, the position of the mirror, and the quantity that is the back action force of the light onto the mirror. So this is phenomenological, right? This can be justified in a more rigorous way, but this is roughly what's happening. You have the mass, you have the force of from the light coupling to the test mass location, and then you can form this interacting system, and then from the light, the device, it has an output field, which then you measure and provide with your signal and the noise. And then when you do this analysis, what you find out is that the structure of the outgoing field contains some Z operator, which gives you the sensing noise. And this alpha is the coupling constant. When the coupling constant is zero, you only have the sensing noise. Only the fluctuation of light comes out. But when you turn up alpha, which is the strength of measurement, the total displacement of the mass will show up in the outgoing field. And the total displacement of the mirror contains the zero-point fluctuation, the signal, which is a classical signal due to the force, classical force you push on the mirror. And then there's the back action force, the effect of the back action force, which also proportional to the alpha, which is the measurement strength. So this is a Heisenberg equation, Heisenberg picture equation. So, and then you can basically say that given this outgoing field, it turns out the structure of this Hamiltonian, there's not only a Heisenberg uncertainty between the position and momentum of the test mass, but there's also an uncertainty relation that is between the sensing noise operator and the back action force operator of the light to the mass. Because essentially you're bringing in these optical oscillators that couple with the test mass. And this is a statement about the uncertainty principle of the optical field. So once you recognize this uncertainty principle and you calculate the total noise you have for measuring the position of the mirror, you find out that what you do is you take this, you normalize the coefficient in front of this, and you calculate the spectrum. You find out the shot noise spectrum gets scaled by 1 over alpha squared. And alpha is the amplitude of the light, and therefore alpha squared is proportional to the intensity of the light. So this is the shot noise, and you have a sensing noise, which is the back action force, but then the coupling constant scales it up. And then you have the correlation between these two types of noise, and then you have the zero-point fluctuation of the mirror. So this is your total noise. But then if you make a measurement away from the zero-point fluctuation, for example, if you have a pendulum, zero-point fluctuation is a very low frequency. If you take a measurement at a very high frequency compared with the pendulum frequency, what you will have is you just ignore that, and you have three terms. And you apply the typical trick when you have quantum mechanics. But before that, you say that suppose there's no correlation between the sensing noise and the back action noise. So suppose there is no. So in that case, you find out that you will have two terms in your noise that scales oppositely with the power. And then you can play the trick that the sum of something, two things, is greater than twice the square root of the product. And by doing this, you apply the uncertainty principle without correlation. You can find out that the sensitivity is indeed limited by the standard quantum limit. So this is an argument you can simply obtain and show that when you measure something that has a response to the back action, you always have this kind of trade-off, and it provides you with a limitation. But of course, I mentioned to you that we were going to surpass this. So how would you surpass this limitation? It turns out if you have a correlation between these two types of noise, the back action and the sensing noise, you will be able to, then this whole argument wouldn't work, and then you will have a lower noise compared with the standard quantum limit. But you have to have the right amount of correlation at the right sign. So then how do you do that? How do you provide this correlation in the actual experiments? So we can then return to this problem and also thinking about where really these two types of noise come from. And that's a more physical discussion here, because when you have light that is acting on the mirror, you have an incident on the mirror, the light, this is a phasor diagram for the field, You can think about there's amplitude and phase fluctuations of the light. And since the gravitational wave provides you with a phase shift of light, that is classical, the phase fluctuations will be responsible for the shot noise. On the other hand, the amplitude fluctuation of the light will be providing you with the back action. So the trade-off is between these two types of noises. And then you can see that the shot noise being dominant at higher frequencies means that when you're trying to measure a higher frequency signal, it's the phase fluctuation that is very important in your experiment. The fact that in low frequencies, back action noise is important is a statement that says in low frequencies, the amplitude fluctuation is important. And then, of course, in the intermediate frequencies, it just means these two fluctuations together will give you the total noise. So then the idea is what we can do is we can prepare a squeezed state for the light. A squeezed state is basically one where the amplitude and phase fluctuations have different amount of fluctuations, right? So a phase squeezed light then would allow you to have better sensitivity here, and an amplitude squeezed light will have better sensitivity here. But if you have this kind of things, you're not correlating the two types of noise. You're just simply decreasing the dominant noise. Phase squeeze decreases this noise, amplitude squeeze decreases this noise. But in the middle, that is where correlation really shows up. Because in the middle, when you're really limited by the standard quantum limit, the noise comes from the coherent sum of this noise and that noise. If you have a vacuum or coherent state input, these two types of noise are not correlated because you have this noise ellipse, which is a circle. But then if you actually provide a squeezed state that has a right correlation between the amplitude and phase fluctuations, then you can lower this noise. So one strategy for lowering the entire noise below the standard quantum limit is to inject a squeezed vacuum, a squeezed light in this picture, a squeezed light that has the right squeezing angle in the noise ellipse, which provides a certain combination between the amplitude and phase has to have a lower fluctuation. So, and in the real interferometer, what happens is that the actual signal is due to the anti-symmetric motion of the mirrors that has an anti-symmetric phase shift on the light, then the signal comes out in this way. So therefore, the true place to inject, to squeeze the light is not to squeeze the carrier field here with from the laser, but to provide the incoming field here must be a so-called squeezed vacuum field, which then will combine with the carrier once entering these two arms in the right way to interact with these two mirrors. So in actual experiments, you don't provide a squeezed light for illumination of the interferometer, but you need to inject squeezed vacuum field from the detection port. So that is a strategy for doing this. So you have the nonlinear, you have a nonlinear crystal that is pumped with a double the frequency of your carrier. And then that would allow squeezed vacuum to come out if the phase matching is correct. Then the crystal basically emits pairs of photons, which then is a squeezed vacuum. And then you stick the outgoing port of your crystal into here. Yeah. Yeah, question.
The carrier laser is very powerful. What is the power on the laser that you're crystal?
Oh, that would be very low because the crystals are small, so the energy density will be higher. I don't know the details. Yeah.
What does vacuum mean, I guess?
So it's really not a vacuum. It's a
squeeze
state. It's a squeeze state. It's a squeeze state with no mean value, with zero mean value for the field. So it's not a vacuum.
Squeeze vacuum, right?
Yeah.
Squeeze
vacuum is not a true vacuum. It's a, yeah.
So GEO-600 is it?
Yes, and actually they have already done this in the actual LIGO interferometer. So at the beginning, it was developed at the ANU, and then at Hanover, they developed squeezing at low frequencies, and then they first tried it on GEO-600, and later on, a few years later, this squeezing experiment was done at the LIGO Hanford site. And then after the S6 of LIGO, there is an additional experiment in LIGO which used squeezing to improve the LIGO sensitivity. So in this curve, you can see that there's a 2 dB improvement of the sensitivity beyond the best achieved sensitivity before. So this is a very important demonstration that squeezing works in the frequency band, that LIGO is operating, and it can be used to increase sensitivity for a really wide region.
And so that squeezing works even though you're not actually at the standard quantum limit yet.
Right, right. So this is the illustrating improvement of shot noise limited sensitivity at high frequencies. And this is, in advanced LIGO, the estimate of experimentalists is that you may have 6 dB of squeezing when you account for the optical losses you have in the system. And then when we consider LIGO 3, the conceptual design, we will have a scheme where we lower the noise here and here and everywhere by having a so-called this frequency-dependent squeezing, where the squeeze is amplitude squeezing at low frequency and phase squeezing at high frequency. So that needs a so-called optical filter design, and you know that may be achievable. So and then in this curve, which I showed before, it basically was using this concept of frequency-dependent squeezing. But so the first part of this talk basically tries to illustrate that the quantum mechanics of the mirrors are important. And okay, as a theorist, I you know we like quantum mechanics. But then there are all these other kinds of noise which come from either you know seismic motions or gravity gradient noise due to the Earth's motion, and thermal fluctuations of the coating, thermal fluctuation of your suspension system. All of these are limiting factors from my point of view, but these are really important noise sources that you have to get down in order for the quantum noise to show up. So, and then you can think about having the quantum noise highlighted, this process is basically you're making a system where it becomes quantum. It's isolated from the environment enough so that the quantum fluctuations of light and the quantum fluctuation of the test mass becomes important. So, and this makes LIGO part of a bigger community of quantum optomechanics where people use light or microwave to measure mechanical structures with the motion very close to the pure state, very close to pure state. So, and what do we do with that? Okay, there's what you can do, you can think about quantum technology, you can think about measuring gravitational waves, measuring weak forces, but the other thing is that since we like quantum mechanics, we can also say that we can use this device just to study the quantum mechanics of the mechanical oscillators that we prepare. So now you can say that we can demonstrate quantum mechanics, first of all. Like in the quantum optics community in the 90s, people demonstrate EPR paradox, people demonstrate you know, quantum measurement issues. And in here, we can also say that. We can say that we can prepare quantum states and we let the quantum state of the mass evolve, and we can see whether the evolution is like the Schrodinger equation, for example. So basically, the idea is we can try to test quantum mechanics. And you know, why do we want to test quantum mechanics? You can say, why do we want to test general relativity? Well, in gravitational wave, we talk a lot about testing GR. Well, GR is different from quantum mechanics. I think for GR is really, you have some weak field conclusions, but it's really not like it's seen in the very strong curvature regime. So there are effects that we have not seen. There are a lot of predictions, but we want to use gravitational waves to test the predictions at strong field regime. Hence the strong gravity seminar, I guess. For quantum mechanics, we see quantum mechanics and we're sure that it works. It's really underlying a lot of the modern technology. But I think quantum mechanics is very strange for the reason that we know that the microscopic world is kind of classical in a deterministic way. It satisfies classical mechanics. And when we first learn quantum mechanics, we get very confused because these particles are not particles, they are waves, and they evolve with different rules, seems like. And also the quantum measurement process is very mysterious. When we have a classical system, we can say if you do want to measure something, you have to interact with it, but that interaction can be turned down as much as possible. Therefore, there's no necessary measurement-induced back action. In quantum mechanics, what you do is there are things that the quantum measurement theory has the ingredient that it when you measure something, you have to perturb the conjugate quantity. And also, when you make a measurement, you are not predicting the answer. You can only predict the distribution of your measurement outcome. So that is very mysterious, or that is very different from classical mechanics. And this really gives doubt. Some people feel that, or most people feel that, or many people feel that, there could be either more physics in quantum mechanics than quantum mechanics, which will produce deterministic answers, maybe. And then some other people feel that we have to provide interpretations of quantum mechanics that sounds intuitive. And other people have to feel that we have to adjust ourselves so that we feel OK with quantum mechanics. So it, I think it's a lot of answers. And from an experimental, and you can approach this in two ways. You can approach in the theoretical way or experimental approach. You can try to look for deviations. So I guess here, what I'm trying to, you know, talking about a lot, the idea is there we can think about testing quantum mechanics, aiming with the motivation that perhaps there could be modifications to the physics, to the prescriptions for getting the results. So one type of models are the so-called collapse models. Basically, these are, if you're interested, you can read this review article, which contains a lot of these models and the motivations. Basically, these ones to convert quantum dynamics of waves into a classical appearance by sort of one way or the other by saying that if you have a wave function which is in a pure state of an object, it has to localize randomly to wave packets which are narrower. So now I guess the interpretation is that there will be additional physics, and if you understand those physics, you will be able to know why they're localized in these particular ways, but now we don't know yet what are these mechanisms, and therefore to us this will be a localization of the wave packet. And then you want to study the phenomenology of the collapse. That's my interpretation. Now, how do you study a collapse? So first of all, you realize that because you don't know what is collapsing these wave function, you will know that, okay, this will be a narrower peak in the displacement representation, but you don't know exactly which peak it is. So if you look at the displacement, apparently this distribution should be the same distribution. It's just that there's no coherence anymore between these peaks. But there's a side effect of this kind of collapse, which is if you want to localize the wave packet this way, when you shrink the displacement distribution of a wave packet, you will perturb the momentum. So therefore, a symptom of many of these collapse models is that when you collapse in X, it'll cause a disturbance in P. And a disturbance in P that is random is a diffusion in the phase space that, you know, in the terms of precision measurement, you really have an additional force that is random that is acting on these test masses. So in the practical manner, testing collapse models is testing for additional random forces acting on your test mass. But you have to provide a reason and how much in what frequency dependence are these forces. So there are various models. And the more recent consideration is by Nimrichter, Hornberger, and Hammer. They consider a particular model. And they worked out how the force would scale with the mass of the macroscopic object. So they found two particular models. One of them is called the CSL models. CSL stands for continuous stochastic localization. And then this other one is called the gravity model, is where it's motivated by Diocci and Penrose. And they proposed that any gravitating object would undergo a state collapse. So what they found out is that these forces scale with a particular manner with the masses. And then if you assume that you can measure the force as a standard quantum limit, you get a figure of merit of what kind of mass and what kind of frequency is good for your measurement. And the CSL model basically requires mass to be small and frequency to be small, naively read from this equation. And testing the gravity decoherence model, you need frequency, measurement frequency to be low. Alone, you don't care about the mass. But if you think about it, typically what happens in a precision measurement is that when you have a bigger and bigger test mass, it is easier and easier to go into the regime of low frequency quantum measurements. When you have a very small mechanical oscillator, the operating frequency normally is very high, simply because when you have some restoring, elastic restoring force, when the size of the object is small, the eigenfrequencies are just very high. And it's just easier to achieve better sensitivity at high frequencies for smaller objects. So, and if you see the very, very steep scaling of the M and omega, so you really emphasize a lot on omega in this equation. So at the end, it means that to test collapse models, it is most important to go to low frequencies. And as a consequence of going to low frequencies, it's often good to even have higher masses, because it's often the case that when you go to lower frequency, the scaling prefers lower frequency, a lot lower frequency, and a little bit higher mass. So in any case, I can show a little bit of what you could achieve with some of these collapse models with advanced LIGO and.
The models, they are still probabilistic, the predictions for the outcome experiment.
There.
It's supposed to explain how the wave function goes from before to after. I'm just not using the Born rule. It's supposed to be some dynamical but probabilistic.
It's supposed to also follow the Born's rule.
It explains the Born rule, but you don't just declare a posteriori that the wave function after is whatever.
Right. You don't want to have the abrupt collapse, but you want to have some more gradual collapse.
But it's not trying to say that collapse is deterministic.
But for my preference, or my own preference, is that if it's not making it deterministic, it really does it really help? I mean, in the sense that you're just saying there's some other reason, maybe it is going this way. If it is deterministic, then you have all the consequences of all these bounds on how it could be, because you have the non-locality phenomenology. So you have to really carefully design the mechanism for these. So I think as it goes now, the collapse models are just very phenomenological. And they don't, for example, they don't explain anything in quantum optics, because in quantum optics, you only have photons and being detected. These collapse models only work for mechanical motion. So this must not be the complete physics. It's just an excuse for us to say, OK, let's look for something. And for some of these collapse models, I think one of these versions that described by Nimrichter et al. Was that they say that there's a certain parameter that is the time scale for collapsing. They say that if you measure 10 to the minus 8, maybe it's better. It'll become better than atomic physics experiments. And you can see that in these gravitational wave detectors, we can sort of reach that. So this is the additional noise induced by collapse if the so-called lambda, which is a timescale parameter, is 10 to the minus 6. Well, this really is above the advanced LIGO design curve. If we assume the advanced LIGO, if we really reach this curve, and if we can account for most of our noise from other sources, we can really substantially become better than 10 to the minus 6. And this is 10 to the minus 8. So if you have the next generation of LIGO, you really have a very high chance of at least reaching 10 to the minus 8. So we'll become comparable to this atomic physics bounds for this particular collapse model. But I think the warning is that it's not really known. It's very exploratory. And having a different regime, you know, you never know whether it is better or worse. But you just try to say that we have all of these theories that we can go test. So this is one of the models, which is a collapse model.
How do we understand this picture dynamically for LIGO? So you prepare some quantum state, and then the principle it collapses for some reason.
In this case, if you want to do the literal comparison, it's very difficult. You have to say, I prepare this, I look for the randomness of display.
Exactly.
If you want to do a you can do a so-called state tomography. You can measure the entire wave function by measuring many, many times. But that's very challenging. So what you do is you conceptually convert this collapse process. You do it in your mind. You say, OK, I collapse at disturb P. Therefore, disturbance in P becomes a stochastic force. So I just measure the stochastic force.
Whatever influence is actually causing the waveform collapse just contributes an additional stochastic force to your system.
Yes. So you collapse in X, you become broader in P. That moves you around, and that shows up in your measurement.
Is the scaling of the stochastic force, are you going to be able to presumably you need to be able to distinguish this from other sources of noise.
Right.
You through the scaling, or what's the general? You just think you know understand all the other noise really well.
I think to post an upper limit is easy, but to really make a discovery, that's hard.
Yeah.
You have to understand all the noise, and you have to do the mass scaling.
Right, but you can rule it out if you're able to.
Yeah.
If you don't see the noise, then you can rule it out.
Right. But I think in practice, it's difficult to make a discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to also mention another strategy. So the first one is the collapse models. If you want to think about it, you can say that collapse model is in the phase space. If I consider a Gaussian quantum state, my Gaussian quantum state has a certain profile for the distribution. Collapse models are where this Gaussian packet becomes a little broader in P, and then after the evolution, this will become an X, because distribution of the Wigner function rotates in the phase space for a mechanical oscillator. So this is a very simple-minded explanation. Now, you can say that, okay, apart from additional noise, can I have something else? I think that's what comes to the second part of the talk. You know, there's a quotation, I guess. It's just, you know, because all of these are very speculative, so you better have some quotation from famous people so that you justify. So so I think you have to take his quote and then you have to revert it. So he says if you believe in quantum mechanics, you better quantize gravity, and that's, you know, in the effort of quantizing gravity, considering how to reconcile quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, that's a major research direction. But you can say that, okay, what if he says to any level you believe in quantum mechanics, you have to believe in gravity quantization. So what if we don't believe in quantum mechanics up to some level, then maybe gravity quantization will not be completely necessary, or it'll be quantized not in the same way as we normally think. I think that's the thing. So what we should do is to consider a self-gravitating system that is also in the lab. Okay, so self-gravitating systems in the astrophysics, that's you know, solar system, black hole physics, you have self-gravitating systems. What if you have a self-gravitating quantum mechanical system? You have these test particles, and each of them have a mass. You can say that my Newtonian potential is given by this, you know, and then my potential energy in the Schrodinger equation is given by this. So that's the way you can think about what quantum gravity would take place in the lab in the first order. And then this, you know, if you think about it, it talks about quantizing gravity, but it's totally trivial on the other side in quantum mechanics. Because you say that I'm not quantizing gravity, I just use the usual Schrodinger equation for a gravitationally interacting system. The fact that you can do that implicitly assumes that gravity is quantum. Because quantum mechanics and classical mechanics don't normally mesh together. When they do mesh together, when the self-gravitating system is quantum mechanical, it means the interaction is quantum in a very straightforward way. So as I described here, right? You really have the system driving this operator, which is the gravitational field operator, and then you substitute this. So in here, you're not using quantum field theory, because quantum field theory focuses a lot on the radiative degrees of freedom. Here, you don't have radiation because you're in the near zone, so it's a trivial quantum mechanics problem. But nevertheless, gravity is quantum. So what if you don't have a quantum gravity? So there are people who can consider these, and there are some people in the 60s, they consider the situation where, let's assume that gravity is classical because phi, instead of doing this, it takes the expectation value of this operator in the wave function of the system. And also, other people consider that the phi has an additional noise that's being measured. So you can say that maybe gravity is not quantum in the usual, in these two usual ways. And I'm going to focus more on this second way, because it turns out the second way is easier to detect. Of course, the more absurd the model is, easier to detect it in the actual experiment. But then you think about it, how absurd it is by itself, you know, not the most intuitive thing we would think about. But if you look at the experimental signatures of this theory, which is absurd, the signatures are not very strong. It still needs precision measurements. So I think that's the way you motivate this experiment. You try to rule this out. So let me then quickly go to this idea of ruling out this classical gravity. So basically here, the theory is that you take the expectation value and then you take this, and you get a phi. So, and then you plug this phi into your Schrodinger equation. Now, if you read the book of Bob Wald, Relativity, there's the paragraph that rules this, that says this is just not good. Because the foundation of that argument is basically in the fact that when you take an expectation value of the operator on the quantum state to generate the gravitational field, that's fine on its own, but then it's not okay if you make a quantum measurement. Because if you make a quantum measurement, you're supposed to collapse the quantum state instantaneously. And if you do collapse the quantum state instantaneously, that collapse would violate the source thing here. The source here, if you write down the full four-dimensional tensor relation, it makes the stress energy tensor also jump, and then it violates the Bianchi identity. But my argument, I think, is that we really don't understand how quantum state collapse really happens. So let me, for the moment, forget about that argument and entertain this theory for a little bit more. And then I'll return to the quantum state reduction issue later.
Well, can I ask about that just
Yeah.
So you have the two sides of Einstein's equation.
Right,
then
right.
If T mu nu jumps, then you're saying the Bianchi identity is violated.
Right.
But equivalently, it's saying T mu nu, the local conservation of T mu nu is instantaneously violated.
Yes, because
divergence of T mu nu is instantaneously non-zero.
Yeah, I think this is probably equal to zero in some sense, but this one is not equal to zero because this guy contains the quantum state, which is supposed to jump.
Yeah.
And quantum state, in fact, jumps in a certain wild way in a non-trip. It could jump in different places.
I see. You're saying that the reason it's only a problem in gravity, is because only in gravity do you actually think about the expectations.
So I think if you have electromagnetic field done this way, it's also bad, right? The current conservation would also, if you think about it, if I have an electron, before I make a measurement, my electron is somewhere, and then I look at it, and suddenly it changes. The current density, the mass, the charge density is jumping around. But as long as you don't use that thing to further drive additional physics, you're allowed to do that. Yeah, I think that's intrinsically, that is a problem because it has to do with whether the wave function is an ontological object or epistemological object. It depends on whether the wave function is physical reality or there's a, if it's physical reality, can it really jump in a non-causal way? But the wave function we only use it for certain things. We don't use it to generate additional fundamental fields. And then that was okay for a while. But if we think about using the wave function to generate additional fields, the state collapse suddenly becomes a problem. I will mention that a little later, but let me just say that let's just take the consequence of gravity being quantum versus classical. What's the difference? Take the expectation value. What's the difference in terms of simple physics? In terms of simple physics, what happens is if you have a wave function of the particle, so if you think about a wave function of the particle, there really is, if you have a point particle, that's a problem. Let's think about we have a wave function of a hydrogen, have some proton, but the proton has some internal degrees of freedom that we phenomenologically treat the proton as an object with a matter distribution that has a certain width. The proton has a wave function, which is normally if you have a proton, you don't have the proton 10 to the minus 15 meter wave function. The wave function of the proton depends on how you confine the proton. Suppose we confine the proton in some potential well, and the proton has a wave function like this, but it has an internal motion that has its own matter distribution that is the femtometer width, and that thing has this gravitational potentials. So then you can think about it in the following way. The proton has a wave function like this, but it's a superposition. The matter, depending on where the proton is, each particular location of the proton is associated with a particular gravitational field, and the field is being carried by the proton, as long as the proton is not moving really fast so that there's no radiation. Okay, if the proton is moving really slowly, much less than speed of light, the potential well of the proton follows the proton himself, so he doesn't have a self-interaction to the non-relativistic physics. There's no self-interacting gravitational fields, gravity. There is the gravitational self force, but that's only when the proton starts moving fast or it's in the curved background. Here we have the lab. So the proton does, to very high accuracy, the proton doesn't have a self gravitational force if gravity is quantum. But if gravity is classical, it's different. Because gravity being classical means we have to consider the total matter distribution according to the quantum wave packet of the proton. And suddenly, it doesn't matter where the proton is. If it's the wave function of the proton, if you take this wave packet, you take a matter distribution according to this, and you calculate the potential, you have a broader potential well. And then at different locations, the proton actually feels this additional interaction. So this is very weird, but that is the consequence of having the wave function deciding the gravitational field. You only have one version of the gravitational field, which is consistent with how wide the wave packet is. But then when the particle starts moving around, it feels its own gravity in some sense. It's like you have a scalar field that gravitates in space-time. If your scalar field is strong enough, it curves the background. So you have a self-induced modification of how the scalar wave packet is propagating. It's the same physics in here. So the idea is, how does that? And then if you consider a crystal, if you consider masses which are a crystal, like if you use a crystalline object as your test mass, what happens is these crystals, or even it's a glass, it also works. So the idea is that if you have usual matter, it looks like a continuous object, but it's really very, very much isolated in terms of the matter distribution. Because the atoms are, the size of the atom is really the size of the wave packet of the electrons. And the real mass is in the nuclei. And the nuclei are really focal, localized at very, very small distance. So it means the matter distribution of a crystal is like this. And if you think about it, you have this lattice which is moving. It moves by the center of mass motion. But then the potential well of this lattice, due to the gravitational potential, is very deep at the location of the lattice sites. You can do a calculation. You find out the typical lattice has the nuclei moving around 10 to the minus 12 meters. So the uncertainty of matter distribution is 10 to the minus 12 meters, which is much less than the 10 to the minus 10 meters, which is the lattice separation. So what you have is, if you have this object, if you consider its own gravitational interaction with itself through the nonlinearity in gravity, considering gravity being classical, you find out that you have this amplification of the self-gravity due to the matter congregation near the lattice points. So when you have this, you can write down the so-called addition. You can, if your mass moves much less compared with the size of the uncertainty here, what you find out is you can write down an additional term in the Schrodinger equation. You can linearize around the potential. You have a quadratic potential. And then what you find out is that you have this additional term, which is characterized by an additional frequency. And the additional frequency is given by gm over the cube of the zero-point fluctuation. So when you study, people study gravity, they recognize the time scale here. It's basically the time scale for an object to rotate around a planet, or like circle some kind of star with a density that is given by m over x cubed. So that frequency, OK, the omega g that I didn't consider before. But the idea is this one uses not the density of the usual material, but this is the density of the material near the lattice sites, which is much, much higher than the usual material density. So this gives you a time scale that is actually faster than the typical time scale between the gravitational interaction with two objects which are nearby each other, which is characterized by their mean density, not the density near the lattice site, which is much higher. You can find out that the frequency scale for these interaction, for this additional interaction, for silicon is 4 times 10 to the minus 2 second. And for other materials, it could be as large as 0.1 second to the minus 1. What's the consequence of this effect? So it's just some numbers, but you can think about it right now as a complement to my picture here. So here, what I said, the collapse models are mechanisms where the Wigner function distribution is becoming fatter because of the collapse. But here is an effect where we can say that it's a different one. you know, you can write down the new Heisenberg equations. You find out that the Heisenberg equation has this additional term which governs only the wave pack, the deviation of the ellipse. This term doesn't apply to the expectation value because this one already subtracts the expectation value. So basically it means that you have a harmonic oscillator which satisfies the usual Heisenberg equations with the additional term that modifies the rotation frequency of the quantum uncertainty. So typically when you have a mechanical oscillator you describe in phase space, this is the phase space, right? The X and P will rotate, the mean value will rotate as a frequency, the center of mass, classical frequency that you observe. The quantum ellipse rotates at the same frequency, so it's always like this if you have standard quantum mechanics. But if you have this new version of nonlinearity, you have this additional frequency for the rotation frequency here for the ellipse. So you get a situation where this ellipse and the tip will not always line up. So how would you detect this? So the idea is that, did I cite the paper? Oh, okay, I forgot to cite, okay. Anyway, so the idea is that if you have light quantum field that is interacting with the mass, and then you try to read out the phase of the outgoing light, you will have access to the quantum motion, quantum uncertainty of the test mass, and classical uncertainty. And they will show up at two different frequencies because the quantum frequency now is bigger than the classical one. So the naive thing you can do is to say that let's then assume that also, so the classical peak normally comes from the thermal fluctuation, but the quantum peak comes from the quantum uncertainty of the light driving quantum uncertainty of the test mass and therefore causing the noise ellipse. So therefore, if you have comparable amount of radiation pressure noise and thermal noise, so thermal noise comes from classical forces, radiation pressure comes from the quantum radiation pressure noise is a quantum mechanism. If the two noises are same magnitude, so that means the effects of the noise comes both from the motion of the tip due to classical force driving and the motion of the ellipse, because the ellipse gives you the radiation pressure noise due to the quantum mechanical uncertainty of the mirror. So the idea is if these two frequencies are separated by more than the width of themselves, you will be able to detect this effect. You can calculate the frequency of these two peaks inserting this additional Schrodinger-Newton frequency. What you find out is that the quality factor you need to obtain this separation is actually accessible within the current technology. So if you compute for different materials, the required quality factor is actually different. For silicon, it's easy to build very good crystals. You find out that 100 hertz observation frequency, you need 10 to the 8 quality factor to observe these two peaks. And this is a reasonable quality factor, as I heard. But then if you actually have different materials where these materials have bigger nuclei, and somehow it turns out their nuclei move less from the lattice sites, and therefore you have more mass concentration near the lattice, and you can even have less requirements. So you know, these experiments have not been done, but you know, we're talking to experimentalists and we're thinking about how to realize this in a experimental setting. So, but at the first sight, it looks like this is close to be quite interesting to be able to rule out this classical gravity model. So I think more words, it's basically there are some subtleties in considering this effect, because as I mentioned before, that the quantum state reduction has the issue that led most people to believe that classical gravity is a terrible idea. I think it is true. I think it's actually fair to say that if you only say that gravity is classical without addressing the quantum state reduction issue, is not a complete theory that can just be logical. But I think the idea is, it's actually fun to think about what happens if you try to insist on this, or try to think about this issue in this context. If you draw the space-time diagram of this experiment, you find out that this is the location of the test mass. You have incoming field interacting with the test mass, and then coming out. And in standard quantum mechanics, what you do is you can say I make a state reduction when my light is reaching the detector. But you can also say that I can say that I can project my quantum state even here. So basically, it doesn't matter where you reduce the quantum states. It's a linear system. You have a set of basis vectors you project into that gives you the probability of the measurement outcome, and it doesn't matter where you project. The problem is if your system's quantum state is projected after the interaction between light and mass or before, because the interaction here is nonlinear, it depends on the quantum state of the test mass. Reducing this afterwards and beforehand actually give you a different statistics in your prediction of the quantum measurement in the photocurrent spectrum in your measurement. So then, you know, this is what some our current research is to, you know, try to find out in this toy setting where quantum mechanics is nonlinear, what deviations could you get if you consider quantum state to be reduced after the nonlinear effect or before the nonlinear effect. It turns out the effects are very different. But nevertheless, they all give features around this omega Q frequency. So therefore, it motivates experiments that will be carried out at some low frequencies, and then you look for deviations of the prediction of quantum mechanics away at a particular frequency where the gravity effects is predicted. So this summarizes my talk. Basically, I think what I said is the experiments in gravitational physics and other sort of experiments, they have sensitivity that is enough to prepare the test masses into the pure quantum state, nearly Heisenberg limited. And then I try to motivate that there will be things you look for in these experiments which may try to test whether there are collapses for mechanical objects, which are in addition to the usual environmental effects, whether there will be some effects motivated by gravity. You know, these are speculative theories, but it motivates experimental tests. You know, like we test GR with scalar tensor theories and other theories. Here, the vision, I guess, is to test quantum mechanics in this new regime with parameterized deviations. Either the deviation is in the size of the ellipse or in the deviation of the manner the ellipse moves in phase space. But you can actually say that with experiments, we can try to provide how much this kind of effect and how much this kind of effect we can test for. And then when there are alternative theories, people can plug in and try to see that whether the theory is ruled out or not. So I think that's the message. Thank you.
Going back to your space-time diagram of the experiment, could you stick in any nonlinear quantum optics system there, mm-hmm. ignoring gravity, nonlinear crystals, and you test the same kind of ideas about
collapse? Yes. So here, nonlinear is a different concept than nonlinear quantum mechanics. So nonlinear quantum mechanics means nonlinear optics means the Hamiltonian is not quadratic in the field, but it's kind of higher order. But the evolution equation for the wave function is still linear. So you can still write down Schrodinger equation. Of course, people do second quantization, but you can still write down a joint Schrodinger equation for all the field modes. So in that sense, it's linear. But in here, what you have is the wave function is nonlinear in that sense. It has many strange consequences. I think people try to be, you know, they don't look very natural. And they really break all your faith on quantum mechanics in the sense that we really rely on the linearity of quantum mechanics to get away with quantum state reduction. Because the linearity is essential for the reduction to be done in this theoretical way to be consistent with our prediction and with our logic. If you start nonlinearity, it forces you to really say something about, to really specialize in different versions. So different ways of reducing the quantum state give different answers in when you have a nonlinear quantum mechanics. That could either mean that nonlinearity is just, it does mean that nonlinearity is not a very good feature. But I don't think it And I personally, I don't think it's necessarily, I think it's the chance it's correct is very low, but it really forces us to think about how we build up our theory of quantum mechanics. And I think that's where it is interesting, that you know, when you have this nonlinearity, all of these equivalent interpretations become non-equivalent.
One of the dark matter models to explain our galactic rotation curves is based on ultralight axionic matter, whose equation of motion is described by a Newton-Schrödinger equation. Mm-hmm. Slightly different context, but it's nevertheless a nonlinear looking Schrödinger equation, which is exactly the same form
yes.
of these ultralight particles. Mm-hmm. And they actually dominate everything we see, basically. Everything we see about our galaxy in these mm-hmm. scenarios mm-hmm. would be described by such an equation. Mm. Are there quantum mechanical other experiments we could try to do to test these models? I mean, right now, all the tests people have proposed that I'm aware of are purely classical, asking, you know, do the core cusp forms exist? Does the quantum mechanics introduce any testable?
Yeah, I think the Schrödinger-Newton equation appears in these condensate models because it's a mean field version of the solving the many particle equation. And this analogy has this similarity has been recognized by various people who are also studying these models in quantum mechanical objects. So I think right now I cannot think of a way where this is directly testable in this context. But that's an interesting question. In a related way, I think people are in terms of dark matter. Related with gravitational wave detection or with atom interferometry experiments where precision measurement of the gravitational field is done, people consider this companies of the dark matter. If you assume, but in this model, maybe there is no companies. But I guess depending on the model of the dark matter, if dark matter density has variations, and then when your experiment is moving through the space-time, the dark matter could achieve a change in the gravitational potential. And people are proposing to measure these effects this way. But it's in terms of the physics, it's different. I think it's different physics.
When you were concluding, you were mentioning the idea that you might have a parameterized description of deviation from quantum mechanics for microscopic objects.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is there a framework, parameterized framework along the lines of TPM that would allow you to do that without relying on a specific proposal for a specific
I think we are borrowing ideas from TPM, but I have not seen this framework completely written in some paper. So we're just thinking in this way, because we need to learn the TPM stuff. So I think that would be it's a good way, but it's so we should think about how to do that, but it's not yet established. Oh, but it's nonlinearity. It's only nonlinearity. Okay. So it's, I guess, for the nonlinearity part, is parameterized, but it's parameterizing the nonlinear terms. It's not parameterizing the phenomenology of the evolution of the wave packet. But that the Weinberg is a little bit. I think Weinberg was also motivated by testing GR. So in his paper, in the 1980s. In the 80s, he has several papers, and he was establishing this framework. He's putting terms into the Schrödinger equation, nonlinear terms, and he classified different nonlinear terms. I guess what we can do is to combine those terms with the additional terms in the noise, and then have a full framework.
So, sorry to question again, but in terms of the experimental work, so you mentioned that there's a Vienna group that's been working along those lines?
Yeah, so the Vienna group, I think the Vienna group that I mentioned is working. These are the theory. There's a theory paper. So this is a theory paper by the Vienna group. But they're also doing experiments. So in the paper, there are various upper limits that you could make with existing experiments. So, but they're proposing a dedicated experiment that would have better sensitivity. And also in their paper, the quotation for how well gravitational wave detection can do is kind of not as good what it can really do. But they try to sort of illustrate what kind of experiments can do what kind of test. Yeah. So, but I think what the claim is to really test stringent, we're still very far from testing these models, collapse models. And also there's a gravity collapse, which we're really, really far. And it's very difficult, unless you have an experiment that works in the millihertz band, or maybe 10 millihertz. So you may have to go to space. But then the idea is, can you go justify having a space mission that rules out a very speculative theory? But depends on whether how cheap space missions can get, I guess.
Any other question? If not, Yambe is here till Saturday. He's coming around, what's your three?
Oh, but I'll leave earlier in the morning.
Yeah,
no
one is here till Saturday.
Okay. So then I guess I'm here till Friday evening.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.